Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
All right, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. I am joined by a podcast legend, Jordan Harbinger. Thank you for joining the Charlie Kirk Show today.
Thanks for having me on, man. I appreciate it.
So you have been podcasting like half of my entire life.
I know. It makes me feel so old. And I'm not even 40. So
that's extraordinary.
So I'm older than
you. How long have you been podcasting?
12 and a half years, 13 years almost.
So when you first started podcasting, were iPhones even around?
No, they didn't exist.
So where did podcasts go?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, right? Basically, you had to download iTunes for your PC or your Mac and then use this like text-only navigation to find it. And then you had to sit in front of your frickin' computer while it played.
So
ridiculous.
So you have seen podcasts go from audio files that people might have talked about on their AOL instant messaging system.
Exactly.
To a whole generation of podcast development.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so you've been a pioneer in that space.
Yeah.
What has been the most positive change of that and then the most negative change with that?
The most positive change is that, well, podcasting, and this will be sort of music to your ears, I think, podcasting is really, the word egalitarian isn't quite it. It's really like an equalizer. You can have a ton of social media followers. You can be a famous person and you can still screw up. You can still not do well with podcasts. Mm-hmm. But if you have good content, you're engaging, your fans actually like you or really hate you or some mixture of the two, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the case with your show probably.
Yeah, we have a little bit of hate listening that goes on.
Yeah, I mean, that
still counts as a download.
It still counts as a download, right? So those are the numbers that matter. Whereas you can just be like, you can just show off like your six pack or your butt or whatever on Instagram and you can get a ton of followers. Doesn't mean they're engaged. Doesn't mean they care about you. Podcasting, there's just no shortcut.
Sure. And so what do you think has been a negative of this development? I mean, there's 2 million podcasts out there now?
There's like 800,000, literally.
Yeah.
Literally there are. And
it's an extraordinary amount.
It's a huge amount. 200,000 are being updated regularly.
Okay. You know,
the rest of them are dead. They're pod faded. People stop doing it.
Pod faded.
Yeah.
That's new.
Yeah. I did not make that up. The negative side of it, though, is there are information silos where if I'm listening to a bunch of conservative news media or a bunch of liberal news media, the filter bubble is even worse because it's not like the news where you're flipping through the channels back in the day. Like when we were kids, we had some overlap in our childhood, even though we've already established that I'm old compared to you. We could flip through the channels and you would flip through one and you'd go, oh, there's one opinion. Oh, there's a different opinion.
Sure.
Now, though, you can be on social media and you're in that filter bubble.
You self-segregate yourself.
Yeah. And podcasting makes it seem even more so because now you're spending an hour a day listening to each of these personalities and you're not really getting deep with anybody else's thoughts. So you might even think, well, you know, I read Breitbart and then I read Fox and then I read MSNBC to get a balance. But instead you're going, well, I read one thing on MSNBC and now I listen to 700 hours a month of conservative media and you think you're getting a balanced perspective or vice versa. And you're not. You're actually deluding yourself into thinking that you have a balanced perspective. And it's dangerous. It's more dangerous.
Sure. All right, everybody. A huge week of sports is ahead. And guess what? I've been saying it for weeks. The Ducks of Oregon, they are marching on. They're marching on. They're marching on. Number 7 in the country. We love our Ducks. My dad, my uncle, and my aunt all went to the University of Oregon. Go, Ducks, go. There's some huge games this weekend. Of course, Oregon is at USC. Utah is at Washington. I like Washington to win that. Georgia, Florida. I love this game every single year. That is a turf war game. Got Virginia Tech at Notre Dame and Miami at Florida State. And the World Series is over. The Washington Nationals have won, which is too bad. They booed our great president. That's okay. San Francisco at Arizona. I like San Francisco in the NFL. Minnesota at Kansas City. I like Minnesota. Detroit at Oakland. I like Detroit. Green Bay at LA Chargers. I like LA. And New England at Pittsburgh. I like New England. So we have this thing, and we've won it a couple times, brought to you by our great friends, betonline.ag. That's betonline.ag. Visit betonline.ag. Don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. That's betonline.ag. So if you love sports and you want to get involved with it, there's some amazing college and professional football. Get engaged. Get involved. It's week 8 of the NFL, week 9 of college football. Go to betonline.ag. That's betonline.ag to get engaged. Do it right now. Betonline.ag. Use that promo code podcast1.
So you get some pretty amazing guests.
Yeah, I would say so.
You had Malcolm Gladwell recently.
Malcolm Gladwell, Dennis Rodman was on
recently. That was I didn't listen to the whole episode. Gladwell's interesting.
Yeah.
It seems that he's, I think his weakest book was Blink.
I liked that one, but you're right. If weak, how? Like, I think we're probably on the same page.
For the first time, I disagreed with what he said. I think his whole thesis was incorrect. I don't think your immediate gut reaction is always probably correct.
Oh, yeah. No, I think instincts that are uninformed are worse than
And he did nuance it throughout the book, but I think that was his weakest book. I think his strongest book was Outliers.
I love Outliers, and I liked Blink in that I think we do come up with our brain does a lot of heavy lifting in the subconscious. Like, we talk about this a lot on the Jordan Harbinger show. We have a lot
which
of
everyone should go download.
Thank you. Yeah, we have a lot of like scientists, neuroscientists, and people that are really studying the way the brain works. And our brains do a lot of heavy lifting when we're not consciously thinking about something. But you're right. Most people, their gut, their intuition just really freaking tells them what they already want to hear. So they'll say, my gut says that this is unfair. Well, that's because that's what you freaking
sure.
think.
And so, but Gladwell makes the argument that it's usually more right more times than wrong. I pushed back. I didn't think his argument was actually well built out in the book. And again, I think he's brilliant. I haven't read his recent book. His interview with you I thought was interesting. I thought you did really well. I think he's getting a little bit away from some of his – I think he's getting too far into kind of – at least from the parts at the beginning, and maybe I have a larger antenna for this, into kind of it's like racial identity politics.
I was going to say you're probably not going to like the stories that he's chosen from the
– No, that, and I – Maybe I'm too critical of that, just because I'm
well,
very
you're hyper
much,
attuned to that.
Yeah, and so I found in his previous books, specifically Outliers, it was much more about the mastery of the individual. How does one become a genius or an expert at a certain topic? I felt this recent interview, and I haven't read the book. I felt it was too focused on. I don't want to say victimology, but it was talking more about how structures are unequal. And as a conservative, I find that could be correct at times, but large in part, there's usually other deeper answers behind that. But I thought you did a really good job of diving into that with him.
Thank you, yeah.
Did you read David and Goliath?
I've read all of his books, I think.
There's not a lot, right?
There aren't of his books, you mean?
Yeah,
there's
only like
four,
five or six.
Five?
Yeah, there's Blink, Outliers, David and Goliath, this recent one, and there was another one as part of the
Tipping Point. Yeah, that's the one I always forget.
So was it Tipping Point or Outliers that talks about the mavens?
Oh, man.
I think that was Outliers?
Yeah, that's Outliers.
That was his strongest book, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think it speaks well to – it's funny because it almost does go to in line with what he was sort of saying about with Blink, but it's a little bit of a different science. We do have an affinity for things we already agree with.
Confirmation bias,
of course, yeah. And a lot of us we're not really aware of these cognitive biases that formulate our decisions. And that's what people think when they say, my gut says this. It's like, well, no, your gut says this because confirmation bias, selection bias, recency bias, whatever sort of cognitive bias you've got in there. That's why people – one of us has a relative, or we all have one relative that thinks that they make lights turn off when they walk or drive underneath them, right? Have you ever known anyone who says something like
sure.
that? Yeah. And that's freaking confirmation bias. Like, you don't notice the other 10,000 lights that week that you walked by that didn't turn off. You notice the one that turns off when you turn into your neighborhood, and that happens 1 in 100 times that you do that. So that confirmation bias actually is really dangerous because it's not just about the lights. It dictates all this behavior that you think you see in the world that may or may not really be there. Mm-hmm. So you might think that all people in certain positions of authority are racist. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You've dealt with people in positions of authority 50 times in the last month, flying and traveling around the country. One of them did something that you kind of thought maybe could have been a little bit uncouth. And maybe it was because of your gender or your ethnicity.
Yes.
Therefore, everybody in authority is racist, and therefore the whole structure is racist, and that's dangerous thinking.
I totally, fundamentally agree with you, and I was afraid that Gladwell was getting further in that direction. So what I found, the lesson from Outliers, what I really one of the biggest lessons. Now, he did talk about proximity blessing, and that's not the term he used. But Bill Gates was only able to stay up late and work hard because he was near a specific type of machine at a college, right? Michael Jordan was only able to do the 20,000 hours. I think that's the rule, right?
10,000 hours, 10, which has been proven wrong, actually. It's just a thing. It's a trope.
So it's interesting to hear Gladwell's response to that. But there is some validity to the becoming a master of your, you know, the rage to master is something that people do say has some basis to it. However, I'm much more sympathetic to arguments that talk about how individuals can better themselves and better their lives over a longer period of time, not become routinely critical of structures around them. So I actually think that the maximum utility of kind of critiquing structures around you, I think actually has very little output long term. Because the single individual, the idea that a single individual can singularly change the world is unique only if that individual first improves themselves.
Oh yeah, I think that it's weird that that should even be controversial. I think that
no, this is amazingly controversial in today's time.
It's very and that goes back to what we were saying before. We're like, okay, what should we focus on for this episode? The idea that sitting around and complaining about the structure around you being unfair is the only thing that you should be doing to improve your own life is ludicrous to me. It doesn't mean that you're wrong when you say that. It means that it's kind of like saying, man, that mountain is really high. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to dig underneath it and make it flat for everyone. That's a noble goal. But it seems like probably if you decide that that's even worth it in the first place, you should just get to walking up that mountain.
Sure.
Right. And I realize, look, it's easy for – maybe it's a little bit easier for somebody like me to say because I've been very fortunate in the way that I was raised and that I had good parents. I had parents that instilled a strong work ethic in me, things like that. But it's not – there's just no utility that I can think of from sitting around and going, well, I was dealt a crappy hand, so therefore everything around me needs to change. It just doesn't work.
And there's also no guarantee to success if you do – you have a higher likelihood, but no guarantee if you are born in, you know, suburbia. There's plenty of highest level suicides in suburbia, highest level of mental health depression. I mean, opioid addiction. So do you have lower likelihood for some, you know, some of the other challenges we're talking about? Of course. But there's plenty of people, and I grew up around them in the suburbs I grew up, that have plenty of issues and problems as a byproduct of those things.
Well, we're from the same area. I mean, not the same city or anything.
I'm from the suburbs of Chicago. Are you from like Auburn Hills?
Yeah, right around there. Yeah.
I know Michigan.
Well, yeah. So Michigan, for people that don't know. So suburban Michigan, auto worker. You know, my dad was an auto worker. My mom was a public school teacher. And we were talking kind of before the show about how the unions did the area of Detroit no real favors. And
I totally agree.
I'm not one of those people who thinks like unions should never exist because, of course, when people were losing their hand.
I also agree
hand,
with that. Yeah.
You know, people were my dad was like, man, I saw guys lose their hands in metal stamping machines because they were like, we don't want to put a metal bar here because it costs an extra, you know, quarter to weld one on. And the guys were doing it themselves to make sure that they didn't fall in the freaking machine. Guys were doing that. So you need a union for that. But the problem is when you grant so much power to an organization like that, they eventually go, well, we have to make $75 an hour because everybody needs more money these days. And it's like, that's why we are making robots to do your job.
Precisely. And there's a great social psychologist, Nassim Taleb.
Yeah.
You should get him on your show. Yeah. Are you on your show?
He's coming on my show, yeah.
Oh, okay. So you got to have him talk about the tyranny of the minority, which he talks about. And the unions are a great example of the tyranny of the minority incident. So I agree unions should exist because the guy that loses his hand – so there have to be protections. There has to be, you know, equal access to insurance. All those sorts of things, right? That just I think the reasonable type of collective, you know, bargaining.
Yeah.
However, the tyranny of the minority begins to become tyrannical when that singular incident and, you know, examples of people losing their hands then become, well, that should become perfectly excusable if people show up late to work and they're, you know, they're drunk, because if we don't have unions, all of a sudden people will lose their hands.
Right, yeah.
So then all of a sudden, you know, the golden mean, as Aristotle would talk about, gets totally lost.
There's a book called Against Empathy. Terrible title, but actually the whole point is it's Paul Bloom. He's a like part of that whole like Sam Harris crew.
Is he atheist too?
You know, I'm not sure actually, but the
I like Sam Harris. He's fair.
Yeah, he tries to be for sure. I mean, I like him too.
No, he's at least I think open-minded,
and he's not like hiding the ball, which is so unusual in this day and age. But Paul Bloom's book, Against Empathy, one of the cases in that book is you can't feel bad for, like, the one kid who has this weird disease where you can't feel so bad. Sorry, you should feel bad, of course, for a kid who has a disease. You can't feel so bad that you then go, we have to remake this entire system.
Yes.
Whereby, like...
It's the tyranny of the minority.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
so I'll give
to
you
prove your point.
So I'll give you a harmless example of the tyranny of the minority that Taleb uses, which is the kosher K on a lot of foods. So there are 8 million Jews in America. Not all of them observe kosher laws.
No.
In fact, not even majority of them. In fact, not even a plurality. You're talking about 5% of Jews.
That might even be a high.
That might be high. So yeah. Let's talk about, let's say 400,000 to be generous.
Sure.
So 400,000 people in a country of 330 million people. All of a sudden, a K gets on every single, you know, piece, almost every Coca-Cola or Snicker. Now, I'm perfectly okay with it because it doesn't actually have undue stress or burden on individuals, right? Like,
yeah.
it's not like having a K on that bothers anyone or it...
You don't pay extra
for
it.
No, of course not. Yeah. You don't pay extra for it. So it's perfectly fine, right? So there's no actual tyranny in that minority. So Taleb uses that as an example of how a minority can totally spread. However, an example that would be more modern here, and again, I don't want to get too political, but it is a perfect example of it, is the whole rise of this pronoun garbage, right?
So
it's a college campus thing. So
yeah.
Where you have to self-announce yourself of what pronouns you use to describe yourself. So for example, if I was on a college campus, I'd say, hello, my name's Charlie. I go by pronouns he, him. So it caters to the transgender community, which is 1% of 1% of human beings. And so all of a sudden, all of language then gets thwarted and changed because of catering to a very specific minority.
Yeah, this was confusing for me. And people have tried to explain this to me, and I'm trying to get it because I want to be fair if I'm being unfair in some way. But it is hard for me to see an argument whereby I have to – like if I look at you and I see that you are – let's say that you're actually female but you just have – you've got some facial hair and a haircut usually worn by a man. If I say, hey, dude, or hey, man, come here, you can go, oh, actually, my name's Karen. And I go, oh, God, I'm sorry. And then I'm embarrassed.
Yes.
But normally that happens to me once every like 5 years where I accidentally misgender somebody. So I don't really feel the need to announce that or have like a badge
Now you have to have external policing and now internal policing of all your thoughts and all of your actions and your words, which is highly consequential because of some mistake you might make one in 5 years.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
So it's a total recalibration of the entire pattern of language and speech. So that would be the example of the tyranny of the minority. I'm afraid that our country is now ruled by the tyranny of the minority, and more times than not. And so where the exceptions are now now usurping the rules. So we'll use an example. So I believe that most people in America work hard, right? I think that's a general rule. But all of a sudden we have a belief now that, well, if you don't want to work, you should be able to get money.
Yeah, we were talking about that before, and the whole, like, what was the phrase, like,
unwilling to work. That was in the original draft of the Green New Deal. Which was a piece of legislation.
I've got to look that up because I'm like, I want to find the discussion behind that where they were like, we need to include unwilling
to work. They removed it because they were sort of embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
Someone somewhere thought that was a thing. So there is a portion of the American left, which is small, that does believe that work is exploitation.
Like in general, they believe
this? It's a Rousseauian Marxist view that's I'm talking about radical left. I'm being very, you know, very specific.
The 1% of the 1%.
I wouldn't even say it's that. I would say it's like 10 to 15% of the Democrat Party of the left. And I encounter this a lot on college campuses. They believe that work in general in the current capitalistic system is exploitation. Because the workers do not own the means of production.
Ooh, I did it when I was an exchange student. I went to a country that used to be communist.
Which one?
East Germany.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And so I've seen what that does. In the best case scenario, East Germany was like the best case scenario.
Horrible.
And it was awful.
Yes. And people want to get out. And
yeah, they risk their lives to get out.
A great rule I always talk about is if you have to prevent your people from leaving, you don't have a great country.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree with that.
And so, but the idea, and again, these shouldn't. It bothers me, Jordan, because these are things that you shouldn't have to debate.
I agree.
Work is not exploitation. It's some form of fashion hundreds of years ago, possibly, maybe.
Well, if you were like an indentured servant and you couldn't subsist.
And that wasn't work. That was slavery.
Slavery,
There's a huge difference. So work is a voluntary contract between either an employer, an entrepreneur, and a worker, right? And so when and if Ford Motor Company or Cadillac gets a little bit too rough around the edges, well, how do workers voluntarily have a check against that? That's collective bargaining.
Right.
I'm perfectly okay with that. In fact, I think Republicans and conservatives have been – I think the anti-labor rhetoric in the Republican Party has been destructive over time. I think that we get mislabeled as being too much against collective bargaining. I shouldn't say mislabeled. We are too much against collective bargaining. I'm against it in public sectors first and foremost. I don't think government collective bargaining should exist. Franklin Delano Roosevelt agreed. But in a private company, the freedom association is part what makes a market so powerful.
Look, getting in shape, it's not just about losing weight. It's about learning healthier habits and feeling better about yourself, whether that's your stamina or keeping up with your busy life or finally getting into clothes that you might not be able to get into right now. So look, I'll tell you, I used to love to work out, and then I had a really bad back injury. We're on the mend. We're almost there. It's been about 11 months of rehab. People that have had back injuries, you know exactly what I mean. But look, it's all about diet for me right now. I have to watch my diet, no carbs. I have to be very careful what I eat. And because of that, I've been able to keep my weight down. But look, whether you have specific goals you want to achieve, there's only one place that you can do that, and that's Noom, N-O-O-M. Let me tell you about them. They do a great job of managing your calorie intake, of being able to manage your exercise, and set very specific goals with you. They'll be able to improve your psychological, physical, and social interactions. And guess what? You get interactions with goal specialists and other Noom members. It's N-O-O-M. Noom is a habit-changing solution. So they change habits. You got a bad habit, eat too much chocolate, don't run enough, sleep in too much. Well, Noom changes your habits. And they help users learn to develop new relationship with food through personalized courses. It's based in psychology. So it really helps you get the things done that you need to get done. Guess what? You're human. We understand if you go off track, there's no shaming, just tips to get you back on track tomorrow. Chat with your goal specialist and Noom community to get and give help to people going through the same thing. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Charlie. It's Noom.com/Charlie. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Charlie to start your free trial today. That's Noom.com/Charlie. The last weight loss program you'll ever need. Noom, they do terrific work. Noom.com/Charlie.
So let me ask a question, Jordan.
Sure.
So do you think we are a country that is embracing hard work more and more each year, or do you think we're embracing a sedentary lifestyle more and more each year?
You know, what's weird is I look around me and I'm running a business, running the Jordan Harbinger Show, working my butt off.
Paying a lot in taxes.
Oh my God, don't
even
get me started.
Do you pay too much in taxes?
Do I pay too much? I pay a lot. I would say it's more than I want to pay.
Good.
But let me caveat this. If I could go, you know what? We're building a train from LA to San Francisco. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be really efficient.
Yeah.
Look at how well they're spending all this money. They're cleaning up this homeless problem in San Francisco. It's going to be great. Then I would be like, here's more tax money to get this job done.
That's not happening, Jordan.
That's not what is going on.
They're spending it on occupying Afghanistan.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where your tax money's going.
That kind of stuff, the waste. Knowing people who are deployed overseas that say, yeah, our fuel bill was $400,000 this month because it's getting embezzled by the commanders
in
the
correct.
Taliban. That stuff, you know, that drove me crazy going, $400,000? That's – if I had an extra fuel bill from this one unit in this one area of Afghanistan, the value that could be created with that amount of money is enormous.
Totally. So anyway, going back to hard work versus sedentary, what do you see?
So I look around and I look at other business owners and I go, man, everybody's working their butt off. America's the greatest country in the world. And then I try to hire people and then I go, wow, there's some real superstars out there that are super hungry, but they're being mixed in with a lot of these other people that go, here's the deal. I'm $175 an hour. And I go, how can that be possible in a market where you're worth $50 an hour? And they go, well, I'm going to Japan this summer and I need more money. And I was just like, that is completely detached.
That's an unrelated data point.
It is unrelated. That's good for you. I hope you have a blast in Japan, but that has nothing to do with the amount of money that you're going to get paid for this job. And so I see this happening and I realize, first I just thought, oh, well, this person's crazy. And then I had trouble finding somebody in different areas. You know, I'd get someone in this area and that area and it'd be great. And then every time I go to a new area, I have to like comb through this pool of educated people who should know better than that.
Sure.
And they don't. And I'm like, where is this coming from? Because we've tolerated this for so long that people think it's not weird to be like, I need more money, therefore I'm charging more.
So let's and I don't want to get too political because it actually – my listeners hear about me talking about politics all the time. But do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing for the country or for what you're doing when there are people pushing to give money away for free? Because that's a whole movement.
It is bad. If you need money because you have some sort of disability and you can't get care
totally
anywhere
agree
else,
with you.
That's different, right? So just so we're on the same page there. But this whole like unwilling to work thing, I mean – get willing. I was unwilling to work when I was a teenager too, and my dad was like, "You have to."
So
we have
what? What? Two words I describe people like you. You have hunger and you hustle.
Yeah,
that's probably
yeah,
fair.
Yeah,
right?
I'm hungry to the point where it's like destabilizing for me. I wish I was less hungry.
Yeah,
I could take a freaking break and enjoy my life a little.
I wish I knew what that was about.
I know. What's a vacation?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But how'd you get that way?
My parents, my dad was an auto worker. My mom was a public school teacher.
Yeah,
speaking
but a lot of people have parents like that. What specifically?
Yeah, that's true. I think I realized that my parents were living below their means, which is good for me. And I grew up with a lot of rich friends because I grew up in a nice area of mm-hmm. Michigan, southeastern Michigan.
So you saw something that you wanted?
Well, actually, I saw something that I didn't want. I saw people with a ton of money that were like completely useless and worthless. And that didn't work hard. And I
sure.
went, wow, you're screwed when you get older. I'm going to end up being like your dad, the surgeon, and you're going to end up being yeah. like my
that's
mom's
so,
brother.
That's so interesting because I find very successful people in high school, when they reflect back, I was the exact same way. You're able to project out decades down the road how certain people
will be. It's long-term thinking, yeah. I wasn't right about everybody, but I was right about
I was mostly right
yeah.
in high school. The people who I said were going to be bums. Spot on. And there were a couple outliers, Malcolm yeah. Gladwell. All of a sudden, these guys have their life together. They've
yeah.
lost like 100 pounds and they're owning like auto mechanic shops.
Oh, one of my buddies, he's like working directly with – he was working directly in like the – not the – something in the Pentagon. He's like a defense liaison. And I was like, you were the kid who got detention every day for not paying attention and for throwing things at the chalkboard. Like who are you? So there's the occasional outlier.
Well, and there's some people like that where – They were a house of cards, and as soon as that tumbles down, they get reconstructed mm-hmm. as a new human being. Very rare, though. So typically when people achieve success like you have, there was a moment when you had to restrain yourself against something that would have been tempting. So it could
All
have
the
been.
Time, yeah.
So what was one part – so that we have a lot of young listeners in high school and college. Did you go to college?
I did. I went okay. to college, and then I went to law school.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did you go to college?
Michigan, yeah.
Okay.
Same
go
law
blue.
School. Yeah.
Okay, so you went both same grad and undergrad.
I did,
consecutively,
yeah.
or did you take a break
I
after?
I took 1 year off, and I went to a country That's, called Serbia to teach
yeah.
English.
So yeah. what year did you go to Serbia? After Tito fell? Or?
Yeah, after 2003.
Kosovo? You go to Kosovo
I did
at all?
Go to Kosovo, yeah.
So you lived in Belgrade?
I did. Yeah, I lived in Belgrade. Kosovo was interesting because we were walking around there, and they were like –
It was not a country when you visited.
No, it wasn't.
It
no.
was a disputed territory.
And there were disputes actively going on.
Sure.
I remember we ran into like a German military patrol and they were like, what are you even doing
sure.
here?
Sure. Did you go to Croatia?
I did go to Croatia.
Albania, Bosnia.
Yeah. yeah. yeah.
Isn't it interesting? So for the listeners that don't know, that's called the Balkan Peninsula,
yeah.
formerly Yugoslavia, kept together by a communist dictator, Tito. And then all of a sudden it falls, all these tribes reemerge
right.
and they all want to kill each other.
Exactly.
Anyway, so you took a year off. Did you do humanitarian work or did you?
No, I was just working. I got a scholarship from the Department of Defense that's like a kind of like a Fulbright, but not quite the same
Interesting.
Thing.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so then you came back to University of Michigan Law School.
Yep.
And then at some point you found this interest in content creation. Then.
Yeah. You know, what was going on was I was teaching. I thought I was going to get fired from the law firm because I was – When I was in high school, I was like, I can just show up to the test. I'm naturally kind of clever. I'll teach myself geometry on the test. That went great. And then I got to law school, and everybody was really smart. But I was like, you know what? They're drinking and hanging out all day. I'm going to
sure.
outwork everyone.
So you restrained yourself. That's a big word I tell
yeah.
people. Restraint can be a very good thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I had to switch my competitive advantage from being naturally kind of clever and smart to being like, well, actually
– Disciplined
instead.
So I think – One of the binary choices that our culture glorifies indulgence and demonizes restraint. In fact, restraint has become a negative word.
Yeah.
When in reality, I think it's a very positive thing. I think restraining your human inclinations towards self-indulgence is what makes successful people exceptional.
Well, it's long-term thinking, right? Like, I can sort of do okay in law school and then try to get a job, or I can work my butt off for two, not even the whole 3 years, get a Wall Street job, which is what happened.
So you got a Wall Street job.
I got a Wall Street job, and it was everything you would expect. It was boring and tough.
Where'd you work? Goldman Sachs?
No. I worked at a law firm that had Goldman Sachs as a client.
There you go.
Yeah, so basically.
It's all part of the
that ecosystem. Yeah. And I was like, this isn't for me, but I already knew that. And I thought, I'm going to get fired. I had imposter syndrome, right, where I'm like, they're going to figure out I don't belong here. Everyone's really smart. Everyone's hardworking. Both of my competitive advantages have evaporated. And then I met one of the partners, and he was never in the office. And I was like, he must work from home. So I asked him how he works from home. And he's like, well, I'm not really working from home. I'm bringing in business for the firm. I'm out networking. And I was like, I have to learn that skill set. So that's what I dedicated the first few years of my career to doing. I was like, I need to figure out this networking thing. That eventually translated into dating skills, because all this go out, meet people, know the door guys, know the bartenders, get free drinks, go on, all that networking stuff. Turns out a lot of women wanted to learn that. So I started hanging around with a lot of women, teaching them that. And then guys were like, well, who's this guy with all the girls who never waits in line for anything? Then I started talking about that, and that became the podcast.
Wow.
And that's what got me started 12 plus years ago doing the show.
It's extraordinary. So you had the awareness that – so you had the ability to self-assess that you did not have a competitive advantage currently at this law firm.
Right.
So you were brutally honest with yourself, which most people aren't. Most people will lie to themselves in their current position.
Sure.
Or they won't tell themselves hard truth. And then you had the ability to have adaptation.
Yeah. I basically had to retool. Right. I had to educate myself and fast. And my idea was, nobody knows about networking right now. Nobody's thinking about it. Guys who are listening, guys and gals who are listening to this show that are like 20, they think networking is for old people, and that if you keep your head down and you work and you get to the top, eventually you'll just be granted a network will be bestowed upon you. And that is not
you'll get
true.
Into the right country club.
Right. That's literally what I thought. That's literally what
that
I thought.
You'll meet all the right people.
Yeah, that's exact. I literally thought I make partner by working really hard, go to a country club, there's my network. It's the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
You build the network, and then you get made partner because everyone likes you and trusts you, and you do good work, and then you're in a country club, and that amplifies gasoline on the networking fire. If you're the best programmer in the basement at Amazon, you are now irreplaceable. You will always be in that position. You're never going to manage anyone because they don't want you to do anything else. If you've got a great network and you're bringing business in, you can write your own ticket anywhere you go. In fact, when my law firm, Thatcher, Prophet & Wood, started to go under because of the real estate downturn of 2008, that partner who I was just talking about, he walked into another law firm because he had a book of business. He
of course
could bring the clients
sure
with him. And all the other partners that worked there, they were 2 a.m. on Sunday, they retired.
And so that's how you're able to book very big guests, is then you rolled that network into your podcast.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the podcast is what you do now.
It is what I do now, yeah.
And you have – so do you love what you do?
Yeah, I do, yeah. And I love it so much that it gets me in trouble sometimes because, you know – I have to take a vacation like at some point, and my wife probably wants to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a baby now, and she's like, hey, do you want to like not work all the time? And I have to actively remind myself that there are other things in life besides just doing my show. It's tough.
So from going back to high school, which I think is kind of the launching off point for a lot of this stuff, when you were in high school, would you always out-hustle other people? For things you cared about, not for school.
Oh, yeah, for things I cared,
you cared about.
For things I cared about,
yes.
Yeah. In fact, I ended up getting in trouble because I was so – I so didn't care about school, but I got really interested in like wiretapping and listening to other people's phone conversations that I started cloning cell phones, which is taking cell phones and reprogramming
That's
them.
That's so funny.
And you could listen to other people's calls.
Vincero Watches. This is such a great brand. We love Vincero at the Charlie Kirk Show. They create exceptionally crafted watches and sell them at a fair price. While each watch is painstakingly handcrafted for absolute quality, they come at a fraction of the price of other luxury watches of the same look and feel. Vincero claims to be the best value in their industry, and guess what? I totally agree. They have 18,000 five-star reviews. Can you believe that? 18,000 five-star reviews. It's basically because their modern timepieces masterfully blend fashion and function into one affordable timepiece. An exclusive deal from our partners at Vincero. Look, this is such a great deal. It's 15% off your whole order. I was just talking to a watch expert yesterday, and he says, yeah, Vincero, they're pretty good. I got to tell you, Vincero's great. So go right now to VinceroWatches.com. Use that code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for 15% off. And look, with styles ranging from classic chronos to rugged sports watches, Vincero has a watch for every style, occasion, and price point. If you're a guy, you need a watch. If you know a guy, that guy needs a watch. So go get your watch. And don't forget, Vincero has free worldwide shipping. Whether you are a watch connoisseur or looking for your first timepiece, a Vincero watch is going to exceed your expectations and make you feel more confident. Remember, my listeners get an extra 15% off. Just use the code KIRK, K-I-R-K, when you check out. So go to VinceroWatches.com. That's V-I-N-C-E-R-O watches.com. And use the code KIRK for 15% off your entire order. They've had styles that I've announced sell out completely. So do yourself a huge favor. Go pick out your new accessory. You will not be disappointed. Use that code KIRK, K-I-R-K, for 15% off. That's V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. Use that code KIRK.
So kind of to close all this up, I have a couple remaining questions. What's the biggest mistake that you're comfortable sharing and the lesson you derived from that mistake?
Yeah, ooh.
That you're comfortable sharing.
Yeah, yeah. To... No, I'm trying. I've got some great mistakes that are really horrifying. One, I worked with business partners when I was 27 all the way till I was about 37. And I made the mistake of thinking that everybody that I was working with had the same level of work ethic. And you've got to be really careful. If you're starting a business or even if you're just working in a company, you've got to realize that your work ethic from Michigan or Indiana or Florida or California or New York, it's not necessarily going to be the same as the person working with you. And so we, as humans, this is a very Malcolm Gladwell type thing to say, we think other people think like us. So you're out here busting your butt doing your show, you're doing Turning Point, I'm doing my show, the Jordan Harbinger show, I'm working my butt off in different areas. You think the person sitting next to you, they're going to have the same level of investment. So you get into business marriage by starting a business with them and becoming their partner, and you don't think of it like that. So you're working, 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 and then suddenly you realize this person is drinking their face off 6 nights a week and I'm at home working, and suddenly your relationship will get torn apart. And this is true whether you're working for a company, whether you're working for yourself, whether you're starting a new initiative, you have to be really careful. Mm-hmm. So for me, when I was 37, I ended up with a dramatic split from my business partners. It was really traumatizing, resulted in lawsuits. It was horrible. And I realized 2020 hindsight, I should have left these losers in the dust, you know, like years and years and years before. But I thought that everything would be great because everything was – when you're young, you don't have a time frame for long-term thinking. I sure didn't. And long-term thinking has been the most positive influence on my life. We were talking about this before, retooling, looking at who's going to be a bum later on. When you're 20 years old, you got like a five-year window as a even remote – remotely like an adult, right? So when you can't make long-term decisions because you don't have that time frame. So you have to be really careful. And so for people out there, I would say – dig your well before you're thirsty when it comes to networking and building relationships, and realize that people you don't think are important to you now might be important to you in 5 or 10 years. And if you don't have that relationship going with them, it's impossible to build it and rebuild it like you would have if you'd kept in touch that whole time. And also realize that people you think are superstars and awesome now, if they're doing tortoise in the hair and they're just lollygagging, you will pass them and you will leave them in the dust and you'll really wonder why you put all your eggs in that basket.
Very interesting.
Does that make sense?
Very much so. Sure. So the final question I'll ask here, which is how do you answer when young people say, how do I do what I love? Because there's a whole kind of fulfillment curiosity here. And I push back against it a lot, but I'd love to get your take. Should young people just go and pursue strictly what gives them fulfillment and passion?
No, because you don't really know what that's going to be. So when I first started doing the Jordan Harbinger show, I was like, you know, I don't really have any clue what I'm going to do with myself. I enjoy this process, but I also need to work really hard in sales, and I was doing sales, and I was working really hard in audio production because I didn't have money to hire someone else, and I didn't love doing that necessarily. And I did every element of the jobs in my company and learned how to do each of these skills. And then I started chasing other ways to make money because I needed to actually do that in the beginning. So I started learning all these other skills from people that I thought were probably not going to be interesting or useful. And as it turned out, those became the foundation for what I do now. I never feel like I'm at work these days, but that's the result of doing all of these other things, not following my passion, but bringing passion with me, doing other things that actually needed to get done and building skills along the way, skill stacking. You build these little bricks of capability by doing things you don't want to do, by learning sales because you're going to starve otherwise, by learning how to craft something because you can't afford to hire someone to do it. You shouldn't just do what you think you want to do. everybody's going to be a freaking YouTuber if that's what we end
up doing. Happening.
I know. It's terrible. And these people that have not earned their position to be some sort of pundit are now like they're Instagrammers.
Well, that's what I have. We know a little bit about that. Jordan, this has been great. Everyone go subscribe to the Jordan Harbinger Show. You hustle. You have hunger. And that's what this country is all about.
Thank you, man.
Glad you're able to succeed. Thanks for coming out.
Appreciate it.